Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Today we are very pleased and excited to have with us Dr. Jeff Leininger. Jeff is an old friend. He was assistant pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge for 6 years, where he worked on his MPhil and his PhD at Cambridge University in the area of the English Reformation. And Jeff currently serves as the campus pastor for Concordia University of Chicago, formerly known as Concordia River Forest. And it is wonderful to have you with us, Jeff, and we look forward to having a conversation about the antecedents of the English Reformation. Welcome.
Thanks so much, John. I'm delighted to be here and very much enjoy this topic, especially as a Lutheran pastor, but also as somebody that has studied the English Reformation in depth as a scholar. It's a topic of great excitement for me.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things there, Lutheran and the English Reformation. When Lutherans hear about Reformation, they automatically think of 1517, Martin Luther, 95 Theses, all that stuff. But in the UK, when we hear the word Reformation, they don't think Germany, they don't think the continent, they think of the English Reformation. Can you perhaps give us a little shorthand of the difference between the two, and is there a real difference?
Yeah, that's a great question. For sure, in the UK, people, when they think of the English Reformation, they go immediately to Henry VIII and the Six Wives and the production of the Bible in English. They think of names like William Tyndale. The English Reformation is happening just a little bit later from, it's, you know, we normally say between 1530 and 1580, whereas the Lutheran Reformation starts a bit before that. And we think about 1517 being from Martin Luther. But there are some quite a bit of I guess I would say cross-pollination. There's a lot of interaction that happens between the two, between what's happening in Germany, of course, initially, and then as things get moving on in England, there's a lot of connections between the two, which I hope that we can explore in our talks together.
And we indeed want to do that. I mean, we are talking about the groundwork for the English Reformation, and you mentioned there are a number of areas. Can you talk to us about some of those areas that really did begin the process?
Yeah, I think setting the stage is a great way of saying it, or maybe what was the ground like? What were the things that were in place that made it possible that England could go in 1530 from a completely traditional Catholic country to 1580 being a Protestant nation, and that being, of course, the English identity, or a major part of the English identity for centuries in the British Empire. So what was it that enabled that change? I think it's important to say that, of course, Henry VIII and his difficulties with his first marriage, I shouldn't say difficulties with his first marriage, we all know Catherine of Aragon was not able to have a male heir, and that a great discussion for the future would be all about that. But we know that the king's matter was driving everything. And we know that if Henry VIII hadn't wanted to divorce his first wife and marry Anne Boleyn, you know, the English Reformation probably wouldn't have happened. That's pretty much assumed. But my question for today is, what were the things that were in the ground, so to speak, or what were the things set on stage that were able to make all of that happen eventually at between 1530 and 1580? And I'd like to talk about four possible things that would lead up to the English Reformation. One is the Lollards, and we think of John Wycliffe. Another possibility might be the decline or decay of the traditional Catholic Church. Another one is the Renaissance Christian humanism. And then another is the influence of Lutherans, especially Luther himself and Robert Barnes and William Tyndale. So really, John, four areas I think that we could talk about that may have set the stage for the English Reformation and the scholarly debates about those. So the Lollards, the the decline and decay of the traditional Catholic Church, the influence of Renaissance Christian humanism, and the influence of Lutherans. Those four areas, I think, are great in terms of different topics for setting the stage.
Super. Well, let's go to those. Let's go to the Lollards. And you mentioned John Wycliffe. Now, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but John Wycliffe was quite a while before Henry VIII. So you're talking that this is going on for well over 100 years. Is that right?
Yes. When we think about John Wycliffe, he dies in 1384. And when people think about the Wycliffe and the Lollards, they use the term Protestants before the Reformation. Protestants before the Reformation. And there's good reason why you might think that and use that term. A little bit of background on John Wycliffe. He was an Oxford student and a scholar in the 1370s, so he wasn't just a sort of common ignorant preacher. I mean, he actually had a university education. But he sent out poor preachers. He sent out preachers to preach the word, and many of them were burned for heresy. And they taught things like Christian tradition cannot contradict scripture. John, what does that sound like to you?
It sounds like something that you hear in Lutherans a lot.
Yeah, sola scriptura, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
they produced vernacular scriptures. So they did not produce the first English Bibles, but they did a lot of work in terms of translating the Bible into English and then dispersing it and disseminating it around. Very small pocket translations were distributed. They questioned the authority of the Pope. In fact, they even called the Pope the Antichrist. And they would make statements that, any sort of spiritual authority given to bishops or to popes or to councils is not given per se, but lent. It can be taken away if it's misused. They even questioned certain Catholic doctrines like transubstantiation, the buying and selling of indulgences, aspects of medieval piety like pilgrimages. They called out the monastic institutions for corruptions. So as you can see, John, there's a lot of good reasons to sort of think about them in terms of Protestants before the Reformation.
Now, you mentioned all those things, Jeff. It seems to me that this would get these guys in a lot of trouble with the authorities. How did Wycliffe survive?
Well, in the end, he didn't. He was, what happens is that they become associated with some of the gentry and even some of the feudal lords in England that give them some measure of protection. So these issues are never just theological. There's always some politics involved. And we know this with Martin Luther, of course, too, that why does Martin Luther survive, John? What would you say to that question?
Well, yeah, he had his prince that took care of him.
That's right, yeah. And so there's some of that. It also happens with the Lollards and John Wycliffe, that they get some protection. But also, they become very much underground and secret. Many of them don't actually leave the Catholic Church. They stay participating in the Catholic Church, but they have their secret meetings, their readings of scriptures in English, their vernacular devotional materials, and they have these sort of secret meetings while at the same time participating, in the life of the Catholic Church at the time. So they get some protection, and then there is some secrecy. And so that's why they're able to survive up until the Reformation.
Okay. And why were they called Lollards?
That's a good question. The term Lollard is a late medieval word that has to do with mumming and mummery. And we don't know for sure, but it seems like their prayers or their conversations would be quiet and maybe sort of sound like they're kind of mumming a little bit. And so that may be where the term comes from.
Now, we were talking about the sort of 1370s, 80s with Wycliffe. What happens after Wycliffe dies? Again, is my understanding the Lollards sort of break up into small, quite, as you mentioned, quiet, secretive groups. How did their influence continue, and how were they viewed by the authorities? Did they try and stamp them out, or did they let them carry on?
Yes, they do eventually. The Council of Constance in 415 does outlaw them as heretics. And the kind of irony about this is that in 1384, John Wycliffe dies. But then when he's condemned as a heretic in 1415, his body is exhumed. He's tried and found guilty, surprise, surprise. And then he's burned. His body is burned. And then his body is thrown into the local river. So he is sort of excommunicated after he's dead, which is kind of a difficult thing to do, but was actually not uncommon in those times. And so they are condemned for heresy. And then in the 1500s, there's a strong renewal in amongst certain bishops in England to prosecute heretics, partly because of the fears of some of the things that are happening on the continent over with the Lutherans. But so they step up their efforts, and they do end up burning quite a few heretics, and they do try to stamp out the Lollards. And so they do have to go into more and more hiding and become more secretive. But they do survive up until the Reformation.
And what was their effect, or do we know what their effect was on Henry, on his court, on those who surrounded him? Did their theological perspectives have any real impact upon the English Reformation, and in what ways?
That's the great scholarly question. And so congratulations, you've got right to the point of what the controversy is in terms of the scholarship. On the one hand, the correlation is so strong, isn't it? When we talk about them, John, we talk about vernacular scriptures, the Pope is the Antichrist, reading of devotional texts, criticism of doctrines of the Catholic Church and practices of the Catholic Church. I mean, it certainly seems to line up with the Protestant Reformation. And the other really strong correlation is that the places that the Lollards are very strong, and where they are strongly persecuted, is in the southeastern parts of England, and that's where the Reformation also seems to arise quickly and strongly. So there are these two great correlations, one correlation being theological, obvious, the other correlation being geographical. So that's one side of the scholarship. And so for many decades, people just have assumed that, well, Lollards led up to the Reformation. The other side of the debate, though, is that when you actually get down to what is causing the changes and what are the reformers reading, you don't get a lot of connection between the Lollards and the Protestant reformers. They discover the Lollards, and they certainly print their texts, but what is converting them? What is driving the Protestant reformers? It's not so much the Lollard texts. It's Luther, it's Erasmus, it's their own exploration of the scriptures that seem to be really driving the Protestant Reformation. And so the other side of the scholarly argument is people will say that, well, there's a lot of correlation there, but the actual causation, when you get down to the historical connections, there's just not a lot there. And so that's the scholarly debate when you say, well, were the Lollards part of the fertile soil that led to the English Reformation? Those that see these strong geographic and theological correlations will say, yes, obviously. But those that actually get down into the nitty gritty of, you know, who are the Protestant reformers reading? Who are they talking to? What are the actual connections between Lollards and those that are causing reform in England? You don't have as much strong connections there. And so that's part of the scholarly debate.
So do we have any of the Lollard texts left? And do we know what they were talking about during this time?
Yes, we do actually. Some of them, now most of the Lollard work and John Wycliffe, this is all before the invention of the printing press. The printing press is about 1455 or so. So a lot of that, their texts were lost because they weren't printed, and they were also persecuted and burned. So we do have surviving Lollard texts that are handwritten. There's devotional material. There's English translations.
What language are they translating from? Is it Greek? Is it Latin? What would it be?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the reformers like Martin Luther and William Tyndale and Erasmus, they are going back to the original sources, the Greek and the Hebrew. The Lollards are still relying upon the Latin Vulgate, and which was the official Bible of the Catholic Church, but they are doing their own English versions of those. And so, as I said, that they have, there are some devotional material, there's commentaries, there's English translations, in handwritten manuscripts that survive. But then at the time of the Reformation, the reformers discover these Protestants before the Reformation, so to speak, and they start printing some of their texts as well. And so we do have some of their texts in printed form. And the Protestant reformers really liked discovering these Wycliffe texts because, well, they challenged the authority of the Pope. And they could make the case that in England, there's been this long history of people challenging Catholic authority. And so it was really, for the Protestant reformers, it really fit their purposes very much to grab these texts and to print them and to disseminate them. I can give you a couple quotes from some of these texts. One quote is a woman that is pretty much a traditional Catholic, but she writes this. She says, "I've secretly kept and hold and privately read," so that means privately read within my house, "books, treatises, volumes, and other works written in English, compiled by John Wycliffe, a damned heretic." And so here you have a woman in the parish, Catholic parish in about 1500, saying that, you know, "I too have read these things and read them in secret, even though I know that they're heretical, but there is this attraction of some of these texts for people." Another source that we have for some of the Lollard texts is actually when they worked to condemn them and to declare them as heretics and to fight against their writings, they would, of course, tell people what they were saying and what they were writing. And so we have, because of the heresy trials, we do have some Lollard texts remaining. And this is an interesting, even in some poetry of the era, there is a poet who wrote against the Lollards, and he said this. His name is Thomas Hoccleve, and this is, about 1400, in his address to St. John Oldcastle. He says, "Dispute no more of the sacrament as Holy Church biddeth. Follow it," that is the Holy Church. "Let the Holy Church meddle of the doctrine of Christ's laws and of his beliefs. Let all other folk thereunto incline to the Holy Church. And of our faith no arguments make. Beware Oldcastle," who was a Lollard, "and for Christ's sake climb no more in Holy Writ so high." So, John, you can sort of hear in that quote this idea that don't meddle in this doctrine stuff. Leave that to the experts. Leave that to the Holy Church and to the doctrines of the Holy Church. And here, so we have an example of people writing against the Lollards, saying, you know what, you're messing in things that you shouldn't be messing in. Leave the theology to the experts.
And with that in mind, it makes me wonder, because you were talking about the worship here. How did they view worship? You talked about they stayed within, many of them, within the traditional Catholic Church, but they met together in secret. How did they view that worship? Was it a high church, a low church, a sacramentarian, or a sacramental kind of worship? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, we know a little bit about their worship. Some of what they were doing by staying in the Catholic Church is just doing the bare minimum. So, for example, you might be obligated to attend the Eucharist once a year or twice a year, say, for example, at Easter. So some might do that very minimum because it was required. So some would do the very minimum. Some of them even maintain some jobs, some work that they would do, occupations in the Catholic Church, for example, lighting little candles or being the sexton of the church. They might keep those jobs, but they would supplement that worship with devotional reading, Bible reading, a gathering in the fields or in the forests or in homes. And this is before there's a lot of literacy, and so somebody would read and people would listen. And so they're very much supplementing their regular worship with readings, some preaching too, and preaching and devotional work. But some of them are, when I say they stayed in the Catholic Church, I mean, some of it was just bare minimum because they were legally required to stay. And so they were very much supplementing their life in the public church with the reading of scripture, with being edified by fellowship and devotion and prayer together.
All right. So then let's go to the English Reformation. What happened to the Lollards during Henry's reign and even after that? I mean, there were some giant pendulum swings with what happened. And did they survive? And are there churches today that sort of resemble the Lollards?
What happens is that because of the Council of Constance in 1415, they are condemned as heretics. And so there is always this, you know, even if you want to be a reformer, you don't want to be a heretic, right? And the questions of their sacramental theology, there is a big question about how they viewed the Lord's Supper. And they were considered sacramentarians. That means they had a very low view, a very spiritual view of the Lord's Supper. And so they were suspect always by Henry and some of the English reformers themselves. They liked some of the things that they were writing, but they're very cautious about it because, as we know from in Lutheran Germany and in other places, that the reformers wanted to maintain that they were not a splinter group. They were not a heretic. That they're the original church. That the confession, for example, the Augsburg Confession or the other Protestant confessions, that this is essential Christianity. And so this Lollardy being, and John Wycliffe being a heresy was always something that they kind of kept a bit at arm's length, even though they did like to print and use some of their material. So at the time of the Reformation, both in England and in Germany, now Jan Hus, for example, you know a bit about Jan Hus. He was actually a student of Wycliffe, but only over in Europe. You know, when the Reformation comes, they adapt some of their material and they use it, but they also kind of keep a distance a bit from it because of the charges of heresies. So when it comes to then the English Reformation starts happening in the 1530s, Henry doesn't like them at all because he considers them heretics. Many of them stay underground, but eventually they become, as the Reformation moves forward under Edward VI and eventually even under Elizabeth, they really become just subsumed into the Protestant Church. So the Lollards die out not simply because they're persecuted as heretics, but eventually they just become subsumed and gathered into the Protestant Church of England. And there are some connections with the Puritan movement as well. I think the way to think about the Lollards for today is think of you know, some of our Anabaptist brothers and sisters. Think about low church Christians. They very much have a connection with the teachings of Wycliffe and the Lollardy movement. They see a connection. Those types of churches see a connection with the Lollardy movement, although really what happens is that when the Reformation really starts moving forward, they just become subsumed into the Protestant churches.
So as we come to the end of our interview today, Jeff, what would you sum up as the I suppose, key contributing factors that the Lollards gave to the English Reformation? What really stands out about them?
In my mind, again, the you know, the causation part is really difficult to prove. I think the point here is that they are reading the Bible for themselves, and they're coming up with, you know, centuries before, some of the same conclusions that the reformers do, Martin Luther and John Calvin and Thomas Cranmer, as they read the Bible for themselves. So to me, the kind of historical point is that when they get into the scriptures, reading it in your own language, reading it for yourself, making your own discernment about it, that they're going to end up kind of in with some similar teachings. So to me, that's the kind of the salient point, is that in the English Reformation, the Bible in the hands of the people becomes a very important movement forward, and that they have a lot in common with the predecessors in the Lollardy movement. As I said, though, the sort of historical causations are a little tricky, but the fact that they're reading the scriptures in their own tongue and disseminating that becomes a very important part of the movement.
Dr. Jeff Leininger, we'd like to thank you for helping us to begin our look at the English Reformation and how it came about and some of the antecedents to it. So I'd like to invite our listeners back to hear us next week as we continue our conversation. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.